What were your impressions of the Sikorsky helicopter as opposed to the Bell 47 and the Hiller and the Flying Banana? Did you like that aircraft?
The H-04S?
Right.
Well, of course, that was an operational aircraft as opposed to the Bell, which was a trainer. And that's when we started operational ASW stuff, which again was restricted to daylight because we didn't have enough instruments. Not until the sea tank came along, and then we could do an instrument night and whatever.
All weather flying.
Yeah.
But the Sikorsky, the horse was a substantially larger aircraft than the Bell.
Oh, yeah.
More cabin room, I think, if I remember correctly. Longer range.
Yep.
What were your impressions of that aircraft? Was everybody quite happy to have that in the Navy? As a
Well, it was the next step along, so kind of a good step.
Do you did you have any role to play as CO of the squadron, evaluating any of the aircraft that the Navy was looking at that point in time?
The only one I can recall is, the only one I can recall going down to the States to go to a command plant, and we flew a couple of versions of the command. And it didn't seem to really be what we were looking for. It was pretty complicated. And they were a fairly small company compared to Sikorsky's or Bell, which meant they didn't have all that support, or wouldn't have all that support for a squadron flying the things. had a look at the HUP on one occasion. That seemed to be a fairly good aircraft for what we thought it was going to do, but it didn't have the load lifting capacity that we really needed.
Was the the HUP was the tandem rotor, was it not?
Right, the small tandem rotor.
Do you remember, I seem to remember coming across myself paperwork that suggested that when the Navy was looking at the HUP to put it aboard the Icebreaker, they wanted a dual role capability for that aircraft, not only search and rescue and observation role, but also an ASW role. And you would have probably have been in headquarters at that time on the staff of DNA. Do you remember those discussions or papers about the HUP?
Not particularly. I seem to remember the USN had or maybe it was Piesacki factory in Philadelphia, had a version of it. Cut a hole in the floor and put a, to see it. But I would have, had I been asked, I think I would have said
no.
Thumbs down, yeah.
And that goes back again to the to your previous observation about the limited lift capability of that particular aircraft.
Yeah.
What was that aircraft like to fly, the HUP?
Oh, it was fun.
Was it?
Yeah. It was totally different, really, in many respects. Especially when you were hovering and trying to turn around, and because one of the things that every pilot who ever flew a HUP tried to do, you could stop the front, you know, where you were sitting, and swing the tail around without moving the front.
Oh, I see.
But to try and stop the rear end and swing you around, virtually impossible, however.
That was a single engine aircraft, but it was a tandem rotor. Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
Had a two drives taken off a common shaft.
Okay. What if you can compare the Sikorsky HO4S2, I think it was, and the HOP, were they similar in their capability in terms of range and endurance and that sort of thing, cruising speed?
No, the Sikorsky was streets ahead.
All right. I remember hearing that one of the complaints about the Sikorsky was that for landing operations, for example, aboard the carrier, under certain wind conditions, they were concerned that it was top-heavy and might wind up going over on its side. The center of gravity, I think, was a bit too high in the cabin. Was that
especially
true?
Especially on floats.
Especially on floats, all right.
I don't think it ever had floats on when it was operating up from the carrier.
All right.
But, no, you were sitting a fair distance up there.
All right. So when the Canadian Navy procures the Sikorsky helicopter, the 2 and then later the 3, I think, which was the navalized version, they intended the Sikorsky strictly for the ASW role at that time? Or was it...
That and plane guard.
All right. Now, where were our pilots sent for plane guard training? I've seen some paperwork that suggests that we started out getting that training in the U.S. and then later we trained our own pilots. Is that true?
Seems to me that I think all we ever did was say, okay, you're this detachment going to the carrier, plane guard duties, you know, brief the guys to sit there when they were landing on and sit up here when they're taking off. And that was the training.
All right.
It was the damn helicopter so mobile and so responsive in decent weather. And that you can, you know, it's not that big a, or never seemed to me to be that big a deal.
All right. Okay.
That we'd go and train people to, you know, hover here.
I guess it's a much more efficient system than having a destroyer task for plane guard duties.
Yeah, and cheaper.
Yeah, I would imagine.
And the only thing is you have to have a crewman because if a plane does ditch and the plane guard helicopter goes after him, you put a sling down, yeah, but if the guy isn't capable of getting himself into the sling, you got to have a crewman to get him in the sling.
Right.
So it takes a bit of coordination.
In order to do that.
And the other thing is occasionally the pilot has a problem trying to see where the damn sling is.
Right, because I guess sometimes it's underneath the fuselage and
depends on the wind, depends on a whole bunch of things. But, if the guy is mobile in the water, it's real easy to drop it out ahead of him and then just back up and drag the thing towards him.
So he can grab it.
Oh, lots of little things that, you know, I think all helicopter pilots instinctively know.
To do that.
Yeah, well, it's just a matter really of common sense, I think, you know. If I can't see the damn thing, how do I get it to the guy so I can still see it? Well, put it where you can see it and take it to him.
Right, okay. Yeah, that would make sense.
No.
make the recovery that much easier and quicker.
Yeah.
You want to get them out of the water quickly.
Speed is usually the essential thing.
When you went to headquarters and became staff officer helicopters on the staff of DNA, what were your responsibilities? Do you remember what sort of things you were required to do or that you were tasked to do?
Seems to me any question that ever came up about helicopters from Naval Board or from whoever, I would have to, you know, deal with the damn thing.
Would that include going to the manufacturers themselves to get the response to a question about their engines or airframes or anything like that?
No. airframes and engines generally were handled by the engineers.
All right.
Operations and policies and things like that, that belonged to DNA.
Would costs, as it relates to procurement, be also your responsibility?
All you could do in those terms was write a requirement and do costing and all the rest of it on numbers that you get from the manufacturers. Submit it to DNA, who submitted it to ACNTS Air, who submitted it to the Naval Board. Then they would kick it around and decide, and then if they said yes, okay, then it would go to Department of
PVP, is that?
Yeah, Defense Procurement.
Right.
Right, okay. When you said the letters, I finally triggered, yeah. So it was a complicated bloody system.
Were you, did you have the opportunity when you were on the staff of DNA to go off and visit any of the manufacturers when we were looking at specific aircraft, comparing, say, the Bristol aircraft to any of the American manufacturers at all?
No, we never looked at the Bristol in terms of a replacement that I'm aware of. The only reason that I ever flew one was some RN type or carrier or something came in, and the guy that I knew had known subs courses was flying the damn thing. So he said, come on, go for a ride. So we went for a ride.
Just to go back to your time on DNA, when you're writing up staff requirements, do you get together with the various directorates, on the engineering side, for example, as you're writing up the staff requirements and get input from them, put it all together for a completed draft of a staff requirement for the helicopters? Is that how it normally worked?
To simplify the thing, you'd say, okay, I need a rotary wing craft to lift X number of pounds, to have a range, to have a crew of such and such, to have a versatility that it can handle these roles. That's the staff requirement.
All right.
How you meet the damn thing is, as you just suggested, getting together with the plumbers, talking to the manufacturers, asking them, you know, are these numbers that I've got here realistic? So you kind of kicked it around until it made some sense to most everybody. The biggest snag always seemed to be the number of bucks it was going to cost, because the plumbers always wanted 100% spares. Or maybe even 150%, I can't remember. And you can't blame them, because they have to keep the damn things in the air. The Naval Board didn't want to spend too much of the Naval budget allocation, because nobody had any money. The usual kind of staff situation, wherever you are.
Right. Were you still on the DNA as Staff Officer Helicopters during the Buckingham Trials in 56, the fall of 56? Or had you been posted somewhere else by that point in time? I'll stop it again for a moment. So if the Navy, and specifically DNA, is not working on procurement issues for helicopters, it must have been very busy with the preparations to get ready for the Buckingham Trials in the fall of 1956, making sure that the flight deck and the work had been done on Buckingham in order to fit the flight deck, getting the people together for the air crew, and all the policy issues that would have been involved, getting a ship cast and that sort of thing. Do you have any recollections of working on those sorts of issues?
Not particularly. We had experienced air crew coming up our ears, seems to me, at that time, because everybody was fighting for, you know, didn't want to go to headquarters, wanted to go to sea. And, of course, the plumbers and the dockyard, they had the bulk of the problems in getting the decks all set up and whatever. And then we had a special, a special lot of characters, mostly plumbers, who were working on bear traps and all the rest of this stuff, doing, pushing things around and whatever. We had, the requirement had been stated, operational requirement, we need a deck that can be fitted in a frigate, a destroyer, a DD, whatever, that can handle a rotary wing aircraft under all weather conditions. And, well, period. They had to go and find out how the devil to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they did.
So that would have been Comop Val, I guess, that would have had a larger role to play in the Buckingham trials.
I can't even remember hearing Comop Val.
All right. Do you remember a Lieutenant Commander Benoit from that period?
Benoit.
He wrote many of the reports, the Comop Val reports following the Buckingham trial. That would have been...
No, I probably talked to him often, but...
Right.
Doesn't ring a bell.
Did you have an opportunity to witness any part of the Buckingham trials in your capacity as deputy director?
No, not really. Whoever the staff officer helicopters was at that time, and I can't recall, he was probably the guy that was carrying the can in terms of...
All right.
Coordination and all the rest of it, cooperation.
Just a little bit of an aside here, but it is related somewhat. While the Navy has the Buckingham trials going on in 56, and you're Deputy Director Naval Aviation, do you have any recollections of ongoing disputes between the Navy and the Air Force for control of maritime air, and that dispute or fight taking place on the Sea Air Warfare Committee?
It was always going on, I can tell you that. But whether it was a particularly hot period at that time, I can't recall. Okay. But it was always going on. Always.
And what would you attribute that ongoing dispute to? Just normal inter-service rivalry, or the Air Force wanting to take over control of anything that flew, or... competition for funds?
Well, for a whole bunch of reasons. The Air Force, at that time, their aircraft inventory, I think I'm right, was coming down. They had a squadron of fighters in France. They had a squadron of fighters in Quebec. And they had some Argus aircraft in Greenwood. I think the Charlottetown PEI base had been shut down. So they were kind of scrambling to, you know, more responsibilities or more requirements for them to have more aircraft and whatever. So you look around and you see, I guess at this time we were looking at one or two squadrons of S2F.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were a dozen in each squadron, so 24 aircraft looks like a pretty good number.
Right. do you have any other recollections about your time in Ottawa headquarters on DNA at all, either as staff officer helicopters or as the deputy director, as it relates to the early sort of helicopter trials? Any concerns from a headquarters perspective?
Well, we were always concerned, but specifically in terms of recollection, no, it was another problem that had to be solved, and who best to solve it? Well, kind of sorted it out. Mostly the plumbers were the guys sorting it out, because they were the ones that were doing the bits and pieces and the hands-on sort of working. That all the pilot had to do was get over the deck and drop a line and keep a little tension on it.
Do you remember, and I'm not sure if this ever took place or not, but was there any sort of growing tension or competition between the fixed wing side of naval aviation and the Navy and rotary wing, now that more and more rotary wing aircraft are being procured, and it looks like there's going to be more of a role to play for helicopters in ASW? Was there any competition for resources at all?
I never sensed any.
All right.
No. A lot of fixed wing guys got checked out in choppers, because, you know, all pilots want to get checked out in as many damn aircraft as they can, you know. Let's face it, it was just another aircraft.
All right. I thought that there might have been a little bit more separation between the two sort of communities, the rotary wing on one side.
There was always competition, not particularly in the air, but in terms of, you know, my squadron can outdo your squadron, or outdrink, or outfight, or out whatever. But no, that was just normal sort of. Went on between, when we didn't have helicopters, it went on between the fighter squadrons and the ASW squadrons.
Mm-hmm. Right. So this was just a new arena then.
Healthy competition, that's all.
Right. No, I'm not trying to make anything out of that. I just thought that there might have been...
If I had felt there was any, I'd tell you.
Right. So how long were you on the staff of DNA before you went to your next posting then? Were you there for a full 2 years in Ottawa, in headquarters?
First time I was there from February 49 to September 51. And second time, June 55 to July 57.
So you still would have been at on DNA then for the Ottawa trials that followed Buckingham then in the 1957.
Well, July 57 I went back to Shearwater. So, but at from July 56 to July 57 I was in. The reason I went to Shearwater, frankly, they couldn't find anybody to take command of HS-50.
Oh, I see. All right.
They'd gone through everybody that... Well, I'd been CEO of Chopper Squadron, so... And they asked me, and the personnel guy said, will you? And, you know, it wasn't a matter of go.
Mm-hmm.
He said, will you go? And I said, sure.
So you went back, after leaving headquarters, you went back to Shearwater then?
Yep.
And that would have been in 57.
It was... July 57. Wait a minute.
So you're still on the staff of DNA. And following the Buckingham trials, we have the Ottawa trials, which were in the summer of 1957. The fall of 1957. So you had departed headquarters by that point in time. You'd left in the summer of 57.
Yeah, I left in July 57. I was back in Shearwater as commander of air.
Do you just to go back briefly here for a moment, on the staff of DNA, do you ever remember the Navy evaluating a haul down system that was proposed by a company called Genair?
No, Genair seems to ring a bell, but I don't, whether it was in connection with a haul down system, I can't recall. I think it was some other context.
Right. Genair submitted a number of proposals for the Navy, one to build hangars for the helicopters on the stern of ships, a collapsible hangar.
Mm-hmm. And maybe that was the one.
And H.B. Picken, their president and chief engineer, had also submitted proposals to the Navy for a haul down, two different types of haul down systems to bring a helicopter to the flight deck. And there was a number of meetings held in Ottawa to evaluate the Genair proposal. And a Lieutenant Commander Johnson, engineer type.
Moose Johnson.
Right. Saw problems with the Genair proposal, and he suggested that the RCN just haul the helicopter down with a cable and then secure it to the deck. And I'm just wondering if you had any recollections of either Picken himself, who was their Genair's engineer and president, or of the proposal at all during your time.
It was still VX-10 who were in control.
Right.
Mostly because, well, they had a couple of pilots, but almost all of them were plumber of one sort or another, electrical or aeronautical or steam or both.
Right.
So VX-10 was a technical squadron, really. Didn't have very much to do with policies and things,
mm-hmm. But
it did with safety standards and
right.
All that, you know, evaluating hardware and God knows what.
Okay. So following your time in Ottawa, you became Commander Air at Shearwater, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was in July 57.
57. So the Navy still just had the Sikorsky Horse and now the S-55, I guess, which was the navalized version, and the Bell 47s. Were those the only three types of helicopters in the inventory that you remember?
I think there were a couple of Hups tucked in the back of the hangar somewhere. But
all right.
They don't seem to have flown very much.
Was that because of problems with mechanical problems or serviceability problems?
I think it was spares and I'm not quite sure. I think they kept running out of spares, but I'm not certain.
All right, but the Hups primarily flew off the icebreaker.
Yeah, that was about all that naval aviation, Canadian naval aviation career consisted of was what it did in the icebreaker.
Right, and when we turned the icebreaker back to Department of Transport, then there wasn't much need for the Hup to fly, I guess.
Because the Bell 47 was a little more versatile.
Mm-hmm.
The HO4S3, that by then, I guess, it was a better performing aircraft in terms of operational requirements.
Right.
Maybe you do or maybe you don't. The designators that the USN use,
mm-hmm.
HUP,
mm-hmm.
Helicopter Utility, Piasecki.
Oh, all right. I wasn't sure of that particular designation.
HO4S, Helicopter Operational Mark 4, no, yeah, Mark 4. From Sikorsky, yes.
Oh, I see.
Because there was in that one, there was an HO3S,
mm-hmm.
which was a weird one to fly. Then the HO4S. And the HO4S was Mark 1, Mark 2, Mark, well, I can't remember a 1, a 2, and a 3.
3, right. And if I remember, I think the 3 was the navalized version of that.
Probably, yeah.
Probably Sikorsky. And the Air Force had their S-58, which was an even more modern version, which we used for the Ottawa trials.
Yeah. That was...
we had to borrow it.
It was almost like a Sea King, but didn't have all the smoke and mirrors.
Right.
I shouldn't say that, all the goodies. Didn't have automatic blade folding and all that kind of stuff.
All right. So as Commander Air at Shearwater, you've got a number of aircraft in the inventory now, but we still don't have the Sea Kings yet, and we don't get those until 1963.
Right.
I'll just stop the tape here because we're finished with that.